Lexi, KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Today we have 2025's Nobel Peace Prize winner, the Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. She says the prize is really for the people of Venezuela.
I am just, one person. I certainly do not deserve this.
And the shutdown is hitting federal workers all over the country. One furloughed Colorado worker tells her story. Plus, Khalid's new album celebrates the freedom that comes with embracing your identity. It's Sunday, October 12th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The wife of a well-known Brainerd Lakes area camp director who died by suicide in jail filed a wrongful death lawsuit Thursday against Crow Wing County and one of its correctional officers. Chelsea Perkins has the story.
57-year-old Robert Bob Slaba spent 36 years as director of Confidence Learning Center in East Gull Lake, which provides outdoor experiences for people with disabilities. His February 2024 death occurred within an hour of him being placed in a jail cell after his arrest for driving while intoxicated. The suit states Correctional Officer Brandon Anderson placed him in a general population cell stocked with a sheet and a bunk previously identified by state officials as a suicide hazard, despite a, quote, overwhelming combination of risk factors. Slaba registered a 0.282 blood alcohol concentration and disclosed that he suffered from anxiety, sleeping disorders, a prior suicide attempt within the last 6 months, and past hospitalization for mental health problems. He also answered yes to multiple questions on the jail's mental health screening that, by the jail's own policy, required he be referred for an immediate mental health evaluation. Reached Friday, Crow Wing County Sheriff Eric Klang declined to comment on the lawsuit. Klang did, however, confirm the hazardous bunks have been replaced as of October 2024. The lawsuit seeks financial compensation for Slaba's errors based on two violations of his constitutional rights and his wrongful death under Minnesota law. Attorneys for the defendants will have the opportunity to file an answer to the suit in U.S. District Court. Read more about this story at KAXE.org. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
A faulty breath test may have compromised driving while intoxicated charges in at least three counties because of user error. The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that a Datamaster instrument to test blood alcohol content was installed incorrectly in Aiken, Winona, and Chippewa counties. More than 70 tests in Aiken County could have been compromised, with at least one fourth-degree DWI case being dismissed there due to the error. The error was flagged by Metro Area Defense Attorney Chuck Ramsey, who represented two clients charged with DWI in Aiken County. The BCA notified all law enforcement agencies across the state of the issue and told the Star Tribune that Aiken County had stopped using the device until the error was resolved. While not as heavily attended as the hearing at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds last week, the final public hearing for a contested boundary dispute saw at least a dozen from the Bemidji area speak before the judge. Northern Township seeks to become its own city and construct a new wastewater plant to serve properties on its side of Lake Bemidji. Nearby Bemidji is disputing this move with a counterpetition that would annex properties around the lake into the city limits. Several affected property owners spoke during the Wednesday hearing at the Sanford Center, including Ron Cooperis, who has been gathering signatures for a petition protesting the annexation. Cooperis's petition does not comment on the sewer issue.
The sewer issue kind of muddies up the big issue here, which is annexation. The real core issue here that brings us to this point is that there's been a change in fiscal responsibility philosophies through the years.
Others on the affected route supported Bemidji's annexation petition, claiming it would cost less to connect to the city system than pay the special assessments for Northern's wastewater plant. Beltrami County Commissioner Joe Gould supports Bemidji's petition. He says the city was in the right to annex as cities need to grow. He adds while the regional goal for decades has been to get sewer around the lake, there has been resistance from nearby townships to the city growing by annexation. Gould said in an interview that the differences between Northern and Bemidji are philosophical.
I think it's just the nature of rural way of life, you know. People that live outside of the city, they're used to having a little more flexibility, looser regulations. It's cultural.
Written comments can be submitted to the Court of Administrative Hearings by 4:30 p.m. on October 24th. Northern Township and the City of Bemidji are expected to continue filing items on their respective cases through December 1st, with the judge's decision not expected to come before the end of the year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. We start the program today on the subject of peace. In a few moments, we'll hear from this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner. But first, the Israeli military says the 48 hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza will be freed tomorrow. Of that 48, around 20 are believed to remain alive. That's in exchange for the release of hundreds of Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. It's all part of the ceasefire deal that came into effect late last week, now being monitored by some 200 U.S. troops. Aaron David Miller is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a veteran peace negotiator across multiple American administrations, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Aisha.
So I mentioned the Peace Prize at the top. In 1994, Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres shared the prize for the Oslo Accords, which aimed to reconcile Israelis and Palestinians and give Palestinians self-rule in parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Where does this moment stand in comparison to that one?
That's a fascinating question. Look, I usually default to the negative when it comes to Israeli-Palestinian anything. I've participated in these negotiations for the better part of 20-plus years. Mostly, we failed. Look, this is not a peace agreement. It is not even an inexorable end to the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza. It offers, assuming the presidential leadership that Trump has demonstrated continues, it offers the first break in 2 years of a parade of horrors that Israelis and Palestinians have visited upon one another. And it actually could lead to an end to the war in Gaza.
Well, what do you think are the biggest challenges, you know, assuming the releases and returns go as planned, with the next steps in this process, what do you think will be the biggest challenges?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, Aisha, the reason in 2 years these agreements, there have been two of them, one in November 2023, one in January 2025, never got through the first phase, is because there's a fundamental impasse between Hamas on one hand and the government of Benjamin Netanyahu on the other. Hamas wants to survive as a political organization with its weapons and its tunnel infrastructure intact to try to take over the Palestinian National Movement and increase its influence in the West Bank. The Netanyahu government, on the other hand, wants to see Hamas eradicated as a military organization with no political influence in Gaza. That impasse remains the single greatest challenge here. The first phase will resolve, of the three reasons Gaza has become urgent, the first phase resolves the issue of hostages. That should lead to a a radical diminution in Israeli military activity. There's no justification any longer for comprehensive military offensive actions. And once that environment stabilizes, the UN is already up to 400 trucks a day, which is what, 200 short of what Gaza was getting on October 6th. The problem is how to move to demilitarizing of Hamas's weapons and tunnel infrastructure,
and
how to create a governing structure which has legitimate and authoritative Palestinians involved.
Not to cut you off, but can I ask you then, do you see prospects for a two-state solution now?
No. I think that remains an idea as valid as I think it can be, and I think it's the only solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That idea right now is tethered to a galaxy far, far away, rather than the realities back here on planet Earth. But you've got to end the war in Gaza first and begin to create an alternative pathway for Israelis and Palestinians with presidential leadership. And I come back to this point. Donald Trump is presiding over the undermining of the norms and institutions of a constitutional order he's designed to protect. But let me be very clear here. None of this would be happening. None of it. Without Trump's capacity to pressure and focus primarily on Benjamin Netanyahu, whether he's able to maintain that is unclear.
That's Aaron David Miller. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
The committee says she is, quote, one of the most extraordinary examples of civilian courage in Latin America in recent times. That committee is the Nobel Committee, and they are referring to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, whom they have honored with 2025's Nobel Peace Prize. She's been in hiding since last year when Nicolas Maduro claimed victory in an election widely seen by independent experts as fraudulent. Maria Corina Machado, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Aisha. My pleasure.
What was it like to receive that phone call? Were you expecting it?
Of course not. Absolutely not. I'm still in shock. I think it's still unbelievable.
You have been shot at, targeted by federal prosecutors, banned from running for office. You are in hiding right now. Why stay in Venezuela when you can leave and rally the world to your cause?
Well, first of all, because I only conceive my life in freedom and in my country. And secondly, because I believe I'm much more useful for our cause here, close to our people.
You dedicated your Nobel to President Trump. Is that because you hope that he will help to force Maduro out?
I dedicate it to the people of Venezuela and President Trump because I think it's the correct thing to do, not only for what he has been doing in the last months to solve long and painful conflicts around the world, but precisely for what he's doing right now for the Americas. Because this is not only about Venezuela. Once Maduro goes, the Cuban regime will follow, the Nicaraguan regime will follow, and for the first time in history, we will have the Americas free of communism and narco dictatorships.
The U.S. military has attacked small boats leaving Venezuela. It says they were carrying drugs, but it hasn't offered evidence to that effect. Do you support those strikes, even though they may amount to extrajudicial killings?
Well, first of all, there is no doubt that Venezuela has turned the main channel of cocaine and drug trafficking in the region. Mm. So everybody knows that the Cartel of los Soles is one of the main criminal structures in the world. Maduro is the head of that cartel, and they have taken over. The cartel has taken control of everything, and it's torturing, destroying, persecuting millions of Venezuelans. They have forced a third of our population to flee, and they are destabilizing intentionally the region and undermining the institutions in the United States, because they have turned Venezuela into the safe haven of the enemies of the United States, Iran, China, Russia, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others.
Do you think that those strikes then are justified in your eyes?
I believe that you need to cut the flows of illegal criminal business. We have been asking for years the international community to stop those flows.
The Maduro government is saying that the Trump administration is using these strikes as a pretext for regime change. Would you feel comfortable if the U.S. hit targets on Venezuelan soil? The history of U.S. intervention on the continent is not a happy one.
Well, first of all, I want to be very clear with this. Regime change was already mandated by the Venezuelan people on July 28, 2024. What we're talking about is a transition to democracy. And this is a very important point, because the narrative of the regime right now is that if Maduro goes, chaos will come. That's absolutely false. We are ready, and we will handle a peaceful, smooth transition to democracy that will make millions of Venezuelans that have been forced to flee come immediately back to build their country.
Do you feel like Trump is a reliable ally? I mean, he still has a relationship with Maduro. Chevron is still in Venezuela. And Trump has worked, you know, very hard to end the temporary protected status for 300,000 Venezuelans who fled to the U.S. to try to get away from the kind of Venezuelan leadership that you have long opposed.
I have no doubt that President Trump has been clear in his message regarding the national security of the United States and the security of the Americas as a whole. And this is a win-win situation, because think of this. We will create a security shield in the heart of our continent. We will push out Iranians and Russians and terrorist groups, but also we will open huge opportunities for business and investment. Venezuela is unique in terms of our natural endowments.
When the committee called to tell you that you'd won, you said, "I'm just one person." What is your message to the average person out there who think, "I'm just one person, what can I do to protect democracy?"
I think that the main lesson that we have learned of Venezuelans during these long years is co-responsibility. It all depends on you, on the people. The people is not an abstract concept. It's made by millions of conscious citizens that understand that citizenship has to do with rights and duties. From a cultural perspective, this is also a great threshold in our history, and for good and for long. We are going to build institutions that I know that will last for centuries to come.
That's Maria Corina Machado, winner of the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE on this Sunday morning. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region, heard on the morning show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Police in Mississippi are looking for suspects following a mass shooting Friday night during a high school homecoming celebration. Six people were killed. Authorities say around 20 others were injured. In a separate Mississippi shooting, an 18-year-old person of interest is in custody in a homecoming shooting that left two people dead. A federal appeals court has left in place a lower court order blocking President Trump's deployment of National Guard troops to the Chicago area. However, the court says the troops can stay in the state and remain under federal control. And in Major League Baseball, the American League Championship Series begins tonight. The Seattle Mariners and Toronto Blue Jays are playing for the pennant. Last night, the Milwaukee Brewers advanced to play the Los Angeles Dodgers for the National League title. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeInCookware.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. There's still no end in sight to the federal shutdown, and that leaves many furloughed employees struggling with how they'll get by. NPR's Jennifer Ludden spoke with a single mom in Colorado worried about her finances and her family.
In a way, Stephanie Rogers started preparing for this moment months ago when she and her two daughters moved in with her mom half an hour south of Denver. Add two dogs and after-school snack time is a bit chaotic. Rogers is 44, divorced with no child support, and worried about the high cost of everything. This way, they both save money, and her mom, Nina Chapman, loves having her granddaughters around.
I was grateful we had a basement. It was just a wonderful area to put everybody, so.
But the move also seemed smart, given the uncertainty of a new administration focused on shrinking government and Rogers' memory of the last federal shutdown in 2018.
We're living that reality now. And so that is our decision to just make sure all of us survive this process.
Rogers has been a microbiologist with the Food and Drug Administration for 16 years and is a chapter president with the National Treasury Employees Union. When the previous shutdown dragged on for 35 days, she was utterly unprepared, she says, so planned better this time. In the weeks before, she rushed to squeeze in medical appointments and requested early refills of the kids' medication. She wasn't sure she'd be able to afford them without her paycheck. She also made a painful decision.
I had to pull out of my retirement, which has some big tax consequences for next year, as well as I don't want to take away from my retirement.
Rogers has asked for flexibility with her car payment. She's thinking twice about extracurriculars for the girls who are 10 and 12, like field trips that cost extra or volleyball games that are a long drive away. And the plan was to buy only essential food.
In fact, we just had our freezer go out. And we lost our meat. And that's just devastating to us because we were counting on that to get us through this.
Rogers has also applied for state unemployment. Furloughed federal workers are generally eligible for that, though they must refund the money when the shutdown ends after they get any regular paychecks that were withheld. But President Trump has floated the idea that some workers might be denied back pay, despite a law he signed mandating it in 2019. He's also threatened to permanently cut, quote, Democrat programs, without saying specifically what that means. And after repeated Trump threats, the administration says it's begun firing more workers. Roger says all of this makes the current shutdown feel very different.
It feels terrible. I don't know if I even have a job when I walk away from this, much less if I will get paid. Do I have health insurance if we don't get back pay? It's a really hard place to be in when you have children who rely on you.
Stephanie Rogers believes she and other federal employees do essential work, things like food inspections that the general public may only appreciate when they're gone. But across the federal government, it's been stressful all year, she says. Mass layoffs and funding cuts have left fewer people working longer hours, only to be sent the message now that they're not really wanted.
My mother worries constantly. My daughter has woken up and said, "Does mommy have a job today?" We don't know what our future looks like.
So even though she's in her dream job, Rogers has started applying for other positions outside the federal government. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
A Christmastime Antarctic cruise in crystalline, icy waters is the setting for Quan Berry's latest novel, The Unveiling. Experienced mostly through the eyes of a film scout and photographer named Stryker, we're taken on a luxury trip gone horribly wrong in so many ways. A mishap earlier in the book leaves our cast of characters stranded, fending for themselves in a hostile, at times mysterious environment, and things get tense and a little strange pretty quickly. Poet, playwright, and novelist Quan Berry joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program.
Fabulous. Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us about this main character, Stryker. I'm just the name. For me, I'm thinking a blonde, tall, like a European man.
Oh, interesting.
That's what I think when I hear Stryker. But she's an African-American woman. She's a photographer who sees nature and people seemingly as they really are. But she's also a bit of an unreliable narrator.
Yeah, so that's an interesting observation about her name. I have to admit, I do maybe steal names from friends and friends of friends. And so one of my friends does have a friend named Stryker. That's her last name. And that's what she goes by.
Oh, okay.
And I knew when I heard that, that I was really just like, yes, because it does so much work, right? But yes, so she is on this Antarctic cruise. She's a film scout. She is looking for locations for a biopic about Ernest Shackleton and his doomed expedition. And I think the name Stryker also maybe clues you into that she's a bit of a loner in many ways, right? She doesn't rely on other people. She's definitely, like I said, like a lone wolf type.
Yeah. And she's trying to navigate herself as this Black woman, and she's the only Black woman and one of the only people of color in the whole group. She's expected to kind of have all the answers. She's looked to for leadership, but she's also very weary of the people around her and not sure who to trust. Like, how did you play with that dynamic?
Yeah. So a lot of what you're, you know, alluding to has to do with her first impressions of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a lot of fun to create these characters and to create her first impressions. Because let's face it, as human beings, we all do that, right? We meet somebody and we very quickly size them up, right? Usually it's not as extreme as, okay, if I were stranded in Antarctica, who would I trust?
But we
tell our stories right from the get-go, right? And so it was really fun, like I said, to create those characters. But hopefully over the course of the book, we begin to see her preconceptions of who these other people are begin to shift and begin to change as more truth comes forward in various ways and in which more things kind of get revealed.
The narrative, it does advance really quickly, and you have these pages that are redacted, which seem to be kind of like blackout moments. But you also have, which I found very different, is this book has no chapters. There are no chapter breaks. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pacing of it just goes. And why did you make that choice?
Yeah. You know, when you're in Antarctica, and especially in December because it's summer, because you're there in December, it means, you know, 24-hour sunlight, right?
Mm.
And so it's the idea that every day sort of feels the same. And because of the cold temperatures, nothing ever really decays. So it's kind of like you're in this place of stasis, right? Everything's sort of stuck in certain kinds of ways. In some ways, the book is almost like a moment. Like, even though a lot of things happen, you know, and I wanted that sort of claustrophobic feel that you're like stuck in this place and you can't get out. So for me, chapters would have introduced like relief for the reader in a way. And I wasn't really interested, you know, I'm like, no, there isn't really relief, right? You go until you go.
You gotta stay in it. You gotta stay in it. This area of the Antarctic Peninsula, I mean, it's like the most remote part of the planet. The continent itself is massive.
Mm-hmm.
It is nature that rules here.
Mm-hmm.
What does that setting tell us about nature's place in this story?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Antarctica is actually the only landmass that was ever truly discovered by human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So all the other discoveries, you know, by people, there were already folks there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Columbus comes here, there's already people here. He's not really discovering anything, you know? And so in thinking about Antarctica, like I said, it's the only place in which there were no people, there were no cities, no civilization. And so I knew that that as a setting would really just be like a ripe place to explore like inner conflict, you know, inner beliefs. There's also, for me, it was rich because I think of Antarctica and all that ice sort of as a mirror, right?
Mm.
So there's a lot of self-reflection and inner dialogue.
This is sort of a scary Gilligan's Island in Antarctica. It's a luxury cruise that goes awry. But you have the classism because you have this wealthy couple, and then you have this very wealthy older couple. Then you have a tech billionaire and her husband. Then you have this, what we believe is to be like a southern couple with a non-binary teen. And then we have three dads and, you know, an adopted daughter. And then we have Stryker, a black woman, who's dealing with all this and also thinking about what it means to be an ally, what it means to be supportive. What does it mean to give of yourself? And what does it mean to be vulnerable with all these people who are so different from you? Talk to me about that.
You know, in talking to some friends of mine who have read the book a bit earlier, one of the words that keeps coming up is this word redemption. And so it's this idea that this particular character in some ways has to make her own inner peace with the decisions that she's made in her life and the tools that are being brought to her to help her, you know, on this journey are these people, like these very different people who represent very different kinds of ways of living a life, right? And so, you know, and thinking about it and thinking about race, you know, she herself as a black woman has certain expectations too, right? You know, there's an epigraph that's the very famous W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, quote about double consciousness.
Yes,
right? This idea of how black people are only allowed a certain kind of way of, you know, being seen by the exterior world, right? And so the book is very much about perception. Because in some ways there is no perception if there's nobody to perceive you. The last thing I would say about this is that there's a line early in the book where she's talking about how, you know, since 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, a certain kind of white person now maybe keeps their cards closer to their chests, you know, in certain kinds of ways. And she's saying that for her, she actually, it makes her harder for her to be able to read them, you know, to know how she should act around them. And so I think ultimately, you know, the book's journey is about all of us like putting our cards down and then just really relating to each other as people.
That's novelist Quan Berry. Her latest novel, The Unveiling, is out now. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Now to a birthday party. Every year, fans of Giuseppe Verdi gather in New York to celebrate him and his operas like La Traviata, Aida, and Otello. The latest gathering was Friday, marking 212 years since the composer's birth, and reporter Jeff London was there.
Verdi Square on Manhattan's Upper West Side is right by a subway station, and that's where a group of Verdi lovers gather by his statue.
My name is August Ventura, and I wanted to find a way to be proud of my Italian heritage, but to look at something that is more of a uniting force, the force of music and the force of this great man, Giuseppe Verdi.
The ceremony begins with a violin solo of some of Verdi's ballet music, performed by Morning Juan. Then Ventura addresses the crowd of mostly senior citizens, which also includes some curious workers in hard hats and passers-by.
He gave us so much, and he is a mirror to which we look at ourselves. Last year, what was on our minds was immigration and human displacement, and these figure prominently in Verdi's operas. This year, I think what is on a lot of our minds is freedom of speech.
Music is handed out, and the group sings a famous chorus from Verdi's first hit opera, Nabucco, about ancient Jews oppressed by the Babylonians. Opera dramaturg Corey Ellison explains that the chorus was written to speak to Italians, who were then striving to create a new country.
Even though he was talking about ancient peoples, ancient biblical peoples, the audiences understood, and we understand that he's talking to all of us during his own time and today and forever.
Many of Verdi's operas deal with not just political struggles, but the personal struggles of outsiders. And they feature beautiful music. One participant names each of Verdi's operas.
Rigoletto, Il Trovatore.
And each participant places a red rose in a vase, which is then set in front of the statue. And as a finale, the group exclaims.
Viva Verdi!
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Georgia is one of the states where companies are keen to build data centers, thanks to generous incentives and a strong fiber infrastructure, especially around Atlanta. Many of those centers are popping up in the Atlanta suburbs, especially as Dormaya Vance of member station WABE in Atlanta reports majority black ones on the south side.
Driving down a dusty back road in Fayetteville, Georgia, about 40 minutes south of downtown Atlanta, you find large parcels of greenery and suburban homes. The drive is serene, but then...
You can't go out without seeing several of those huge construction vehicles on the roads.
Diana Dietz has lived here since the 90s and now tracks data center growth in the area. We stop at a construction site where miles of trees have been cleared. Dietz engages with the worker on the site.
Interesting. I never thought about any of this stuff until they started building a bunch of...
A lot of it is just to feed the QTS thing over there.
Just to feed QTS?
QTS is the latest data center going up here, a 600-acre campus.
I have seen all of the what used to be cozy, quaint, wooded kind of area completely change.
Keisha Scott lives in Planters Ridge, a predominantly black middle-class subdivision. Her house is now right across the street from the new data center. She says she didn't know about the project until after moving in.
And so now I have to come to terms with the fact that what I once thought would be my life here now has significantly changed.
Besides a changing landscape, residents like Scott worry about environmental impacts and the large amount of water and electricity needed to run data centers. Georgia has at least 100 of them in operation, most located south of Atlanta. That's because despite its growing suburbs, there's still more rural land available than in other parts of metro Atlanta, says Lynn McKee. He teaches real estate at Georgia State University.
People don't want these big data centers near their houses. But you go out and you go to South Atlanta or into rural Georgia, there's just land, land, land.
More land is open on the south side, but that's not the only reason for the growth, says Georgia Tech professor Ahmed Saeed.
Georgia is making it very attractive to build data centers here.
That's because of lucrative tax incentives to the industry supported by Georgia's Republican governor, Brian Kemp. He vetoed a bill last year that would have paused the tax exemptions. Residents on the south side are starting to speak out about the impact of data centers in black neighborhoods, and some Republicans want more protections for communities, like State Senator Chuck Hefstetler.
You know, there's some people that want to give away the farm and others that don't want any growth, and I just want us to be smart about it.
But his efforts to do so have stalled in the legislature. Meanwhile, Georgia Power has reversed its efforts to close two coal-fired power plants, saying it now needs them to serve customers with large energy demands. For NPR News, I'm Dormaya Vance in Atlanta.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. ModernEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. And On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Coats for Kids will distribute winter gear for children Saturday, October 18th from 9 to 2 at the Westgate Mall in Brainerd. Use the entrance by the former Joann's store. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. With Palestinians moving back into northern Gaza since a ceasefire agreement came into effect, preparations are underway for aid trucks loaded with supplies to enter Gaza. The UN says it has tens of thousands of metric tons of food, medicine, and other humanitarian supplies ready to enter once Israel gives a green light. The White House is moving to ensure members of the U.S. military are paid amid the government shutdown. President Trump says he has directed the Defense Department to use all available funds. And in New Orleans, Democratic City Council member Helena Marino is set to take the reins of City Hall. Voters handed Marino an outright victory. Preliminary results show she won 55% of the vote, allowing her to avoid a runoff. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Mike is a young man living in the outskirts of society, roaming the streets of London, asking for spare change. Unhoused and struggling with substance abuse, he lands himself in prison for stealing a watch and physically assaulting a man who was trying to help him. 7 months later, he's released and determined to get back on track. But the odds are against him, as his parole officer explains.
You know, we'll put you in touch with local authority and they'll make referrals to housing. But I have to be honest with you, Mike, you're not going to be top priority.
Why is that?
Oh, young male with previous convictions, history of violence, no medical problems or physical disabilities. It's just going to be harder, I have to be honest.
No, I get
it's
that.
Better that you know that from the start.
Yeah.
Frank Delane plays Mike in the new film Urchin, the directorial debut for the young but famed actor Harris Dickinson. The two of them join us now. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
Thanks.
This film focuses on the effects of substance abuse and homelessness. Harris, is there something that you felt like you wanted to capture that people don't generally understand?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of misconceptions around addicts and people that have been through extreme trauma or people that are unhoused. And I think, you know, what we were trying to do is just present it very simply without judgment, present a full life of someone going through really precarious circumstances and show the levity and the humanity. And I think not a lot of people realize how difficult it is once you've been, you know, A, incarcerated, or B, lost touch with any sort of support network and dealing with various different forms of mental health issues. It's incredibly difficult to reassimilate and find your feet again.
And Frank, the character of Mike, certainly he can be easy to root for at times, but at other times, he's a bit of a jerk. He can be vulnerable and polite, but then sometimes he's short-tempered and, you know, violent. How did you approach the challenge of playing this really complex character?
Well, Harris and I, one thing we really wanted to do was to dignify Mike and to make sure that he was a full person, a well-rounded person. I think all human beings have many different colors to their personality, and we are all susceptible to mistakes, to at times behaving in ways that we wished we hadn't. Harris turned me on to some literature. We watched a lot of movies, and then we went into prisons. And yeah, we just, I tried to spend as much time outside as possible and trying to get to grips with the different themes that that we wanted to explore.
And Harris, I mean, there is a view of society at large as well, right? Like you start off with Mike asking people passing by for spare change, then going to a soup kitchen, and then he's chatting with other people who are living on the streets. There's not a lot of dialogue, and Mike is kind of kept at an angle, at a distance. Was that distance meant to show how often, as society, we see homelessness from afar, or we choose to ignore it?
Yes, I think the start of the film, we were very keen on trying to explore him from a more voyeuristic documentary-type situation. And then a lot of the stuff we shot, when Mike was living on the streets and, you know, going up to people, they were real passerbys, and we were quite far away, and we were did that more to hide, you know, so we could get real reactions and incorporate real life into Mike's journey. So it felt like there was a sense of isolation as well, which is ultimately just a part of being in that situation. It's all something we're guilty of it, you know, even myself. We don't have time for everyone. We have busy lives, and a lot of the time we just want to carry on in our bubble and keep things moving. So it's not a it's not an attack or assault on anyone's behavior. It's just an observation, you know.
Frank, also, there's a really powerful scene when your character comes face to face with the person he's assaulted. What do you think that scene tells us about the way we treat guilt, and also about our ability as a society to forgive?
I can't speak about forgiveness really, I suppose, in a societal level. I can speak about the character I was playing in that scene, how we approached the scene. And you know, there was elements of Mike's personality which allowed him to compartmentalize a lot and kind of forget in order to move forward and kind of put things in boxes and like, yeah, that happened, but never mind, forget about it, let's just move on. There's a kind of fantastical thinking that human beings can do, and I think addiction can also feed into that, this sort of just living for the moment, forgetting the past, you know, just trying to move forward, and that is possible until the past comes and smacks you right in the face and you're forced to confront something that you had chosen to forget.
Harris, you're only 29, and you've already had a big success as an actor in hits like The Iron Claw and Baby Girl. Why switch to directing, and what was it like to be behind the camera for the first time?
Directing is always something I wanted to do. I've thought about it for a very long time. It was probably, you know, my first love before acting really took off. So it's been there, kind of bubbling away in the background since I can remember. So I think that now just felt like the perfect moment. I couldn't kind of wait any longer to make this film in particular, you know?
Well, and not to put you on the spot, Frank, but how did Harris do directing?
Listen, Harris is a really good director. I mean this from the bottom of my heart. He's incredibly hands-on, as in he really gets into the scene with you. And always at the forefront was dignifying the characters. And yeah, I think he's an important voice for this generation.
Nice for the ego.
The new film, Urchin, written and directed by Harris Dickinson and starring Frank Delane, is out now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Khalid has written many songs about romance. His music has topped the charts around the world and charmed the hearts of millions of fans. But on his new album, loving and accepting yourself are the big themes. It's called After the Sun Goes Down, and he says that's the time when he truly feels alive.
Sometimes we see darkness and we see the night and we think of fear. But to me, I just think of freedom. I think of empty streets that you just walk on, or just side streets you find yourself following that lead you to a random bar or pub. You know, you work all day and you play all night. And that's kind of what I feel like this album to me sounds like. It just sounds like freedom, like really indulging myself into the beauty of the night.
Too gone up the deep end. No, I can't swim, but I still die for you. Sun goes down in the evening on the east end, but it still shines for you. Stay right there, don't you leave yet. All my secrets, wanna share it all for you. Way too gone up the deep end. No, I can't swim, but I still fall for you. Come on out, let's get it started.
To me, listening to this album, it seems to be all about having fun, and also being young.
Yeah, it really is. It even feels even more youthful now, because I feel like I'm finally able to dive into stories that I've been holding on to for so long. I'm a happy-go-lucky, tongue-in-cheek type of guy that's flirty and fearless. and I feel like now I'm just able to dive into romanticism in a way that there's no bad blood. Like, it's all stories of my nature, which is just a free spirit.
I know some people listening may wonder, is there someone who maybe you dealt with who there could be bad blood, because someone from your romantic past around this time last year outed you, and so basically told your story without you being able to decide how to tell that story.
Right, right.
You confirmed that you're gay. And coming out is generally, I mean, it's hard to do, but it's also so personal. How do you feel now, having come through that?
I think that there's a lot of ownership to bad blood. To have bad blood means that you have to harbor that. It has to live inside of you. And once I was outed, I didn't want to harbor anything. Such a level of negativity. It has nothing to do with me, but everything to do with how I respond. I'm a musician. I'm gonna put it in the music. I'm gonna talk about freedom. I'm gonna talk about liberation. To say that I have bad blood would not be the truth, because I'm living the best times of my life right now.
Oh, what's the benefit? The way you cling onto me, I'm not into it. Not really feeling it. It's like we've been here before. What is happening? You must be out of your mind now. I gotta put you in time out.
What did you learn from that experience? Did it change how you see yourself, how you think the public sees you?
I learned that it's not that bad being truly yourself. I was so scared to reveal sides of myself, because I was always afraid that they would be weaponized against me, but I'm being embraced. I just learned so much. I learned true freedom. Like, I thought I was free, but I was really a prisoner of my own anxiety. Now I just feel like I'm just able to just walk with some pep in my step and my head held high.
Well, and there's, you have this song, Hurt People.
Oh, I've known hurt before, hurt before.
And you're talking about connecting with other people who've also been hurt, who may understand that hurt. Did your experience that you went through last year, did that help inspire that song?
I think that Hurt People, to me, it actually was inspired more by the passing of my father, and also just true empathy. I understand that if I let the terrible things that happened to my life consume me, that I would be a very hurtful person.
Mm. You know, I lost my father as a young child, and you know, you're a child, so you don't get to really know them. And then there's so many experiences that they miss. How do you make sense of it? How do you deal with that grief?
Oh my God, it's still hard.
Yeah.
Grief never gets easy. My father passed away when I was in the second grade, and I'm still having conversations as a 27-year-old man that are bringing me to tears. Thinking about the conversations that you could have had, the support that I could have even gotten from my father when I was outed. I didn't get to have that conversation with him. And so to live without that connection, you will always feel the loss.
Yeah, and the wonder of what could have been.
Exactly.
See, no one wants a poison inside their veins. We all know that the ocean can't stop his waves. And like a wilted flower that loses light, I crawl into my shadow and then I hide. Cause I
You've obviously been through a lot to be the artist that you are today. Talk to me about how your time growing up, how that shaped you. I know that you moved around a lot. How is that reflected in your album?
Being a military kid, living overseas in Germany, when you step outside of the base and seeing just a completely different culture, and then even coming back onto the base and seeing nothing but American culture, just gave me a lot of perspective on life as a storyteller. But then also, you know, moving into Northern New York, American folk music is really big in the North Country and gave me a stronger sensibility of like the importance of lyricism. Being raised in the South as well, R&B is always at the center of my core. The different pockets of the world that I was able to live in keeps me wanting to remain so worldly.
Yeah. Take a leap with me, why don't you fall in my arms? My only intention was to heal all your scars.
After the Sun Goes Down is full of like romantic love songs. Has your idea of love changed since you released your first album nearly a decade ago?
Yes, because I feel like when we speak about love, we have to speak about respect. And I feel like in the beginning, my music was an idea of love that I never felt that I longed for. So there's a lot of loneliness in that love. I think that there's so much more maturity with the love that I speak now. And I think to be mature is to understand that love doesn't always last forever. But when you experience love, you choose to hold on to it. You choose to give it to others.
That's the musician Khalid talking about his new album, After the Sun Goes Down. Thank you so much.
Thank y'all. Wouldn't want to lead you blind. You've been more than patient, yeah. So I'm gonna make it right. I get strung up and I panic, but then I come to my senses. One more try and I won't give up.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. No games, no words.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. There's a waffle brunch fundraiser for a new dog park in Deer River, Sunday, October 19th from 9 to 1 at the Deer River Vets Club. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Chocolate.